Welcome back to Sophomore Lit. I don't have anything clever to say this time. My name is Ja McCoy, and with me is co-host Jason Snell.
Hello. May Bokanon be with you always.
Right. Now, Jason is probably known to a lot of you who listen to podcasts. Jason was introduced to me by our mutual friend John Syracusa, who is quite frequently a guest on Jason's Incomparable podcast. Do you want to talk a little bit about yourself and where people might have heard you?
Sure. My professional history, I was the editor of Macworld for more than a decade. So I'm in the Apple and tech world. And I do a couple of tech podcasts now, but I about five years ago last week, I started a podcast called The Incomparable, which is about mostly geeky media. So we talk about, and I couldn't decide, like, I'm just not one of those people who can commit to, like, burrow down deep into one thing. So it's about books, it's about TV shows, it's about movies, it's about comics, it's about games, it's sort of about a bunch of stuff. But in all of those cases, it's really about us digging into a work and, you know, essentially critiquing it or talking about why it works and why it doesn't work, whether it's a book or a movie or a TV show. So occasionally we'll do crazy, you know, things like drafts or tournaments. And we're doing a superhero tournament right now, which is really stupid, but it's funny and it's fun. So that's what The Incomparable is. And we've got a bunch of spinoffs now where we play Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like that, too. But that's my non-tech part. And then I've got, like I said, Clockwise and Upgrade are my two technology podcasts, and I've just started a space podcast called Liftoff. So I get around, and I also still, you know, write things, which is my training was journalism, so writing stuff at sixcolors.com.
Well, that brings up an interesting intersection that I do hope to touch on in this podcast, which is we are going to discuss this time one of the works by Kurt Vonnegut. We're not going to discuss the work that you're probably thinking of, which is Slaughterhouse-Five.
This is the other one.
Right. We're going to discuss the earlier novel, Cat's Cradle. And one of the things that I find fascinating about Vonnegut is the way that he straddles the fence between genre fiction and what people would consider literary fiction. Mm-hmm. Full disclosure, this is not a book that I read for class in high school, but when I was in high school, I must have read probably everything that Kurt Vonnegut had published up to that point. He was still writing when I was in high school. I remember when Galapagos came out, it was a big deal for me because
me
it was
too.
the first Kurt Vonnegut book that was new to me.
Me too.
This was the second book I read by Kurt Vonnegut, though. This I remember I had been perusing the adult shelves at my local library, and I came across Breakfast of Champions, which blew my little mind with all of its little drawings and stuff in it. And this was the second book. I had to read everything by Kurt Vonnegut after reading that book, and I read this. So what's your background with this book?
So I believe that my sophomore lit class, so it's perfect, read both Slaughterhouse-Five and Cat's Cradle. And it may be that we read Slaughterhouse-Five my sophomore year and we read Cat's Cradle my junior year, but I definitely remember reading both of them. And I remember getting more out of Slaughterhouse-Five than Cat's Cradle at the time. I remember not being disappointed that Cat's Cradle wasn't as good as Slaughterhouse-Five when I read it. And it turns out now, all this time later, I have almost no memory of what's actually in the book. I think literally what I remember of the book is an image from one of the final chapters, and that's about it. And other than that, it was the one with Ice Nine was sort of all that I could really pull out about it. But like you, when I discovered Vonnegut, I kind of went nuts. And a bunch of my friends did too. I remember a friend of mine just toting Breakfast of Champions around with him. I have a vision of him carrying that around at one point. Galapagos came out in hardcover, and I remember like wanting to get the hardcover when it came out of this crazy book because it was a new Kurt Vonnegut book. And rereading, I can see why. I can see why, because he's kind of a pretty amazing writer. But I think I read this my sophomore year, and if not, it was my junior year. But definitely in class, from one of my, I'm not sure which one, but I think it was probably my Mr. Duggan's sophomore English class.
Well, Vonnegut is, of course, one of the great authors of the baby boom generation and was really taken to heart by the baby boomers. And I think it's interesting that his work gets taught in high schools, or at least that it got taught in high schools in the 70s and 80s, because it was pretty new by that point. And
yeah.
I think what happened was a bunch of ex-hippies ended up teaching literature classes.
Yeah, we got Stranger in a Strange Land in the same class. So it's, and I believe my English, my sophomore lit teacher was like 7 years older than me. I mean, he was a very young teacher. And I think that was part of it too, is he wanted to teach some cool books that were still, that still had enough kind of respectability that he could get them through. And, the, and Vonnegut was definitely in that category, as was Heinlein.
Okay, let's go into a little bit of background here. You can jump in wherever you want to. Kurt Vonnegut Jr. was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. That becomes a point in this book where they, everyone talks about being Hoosiers. And I think that that was, the Hoosier label was one that Kurt Vonnegut wore with ironic pride all his life. He went to Cornell University, dropped out, and in 43, he enlisted in the United States Army. So it was in the final days of World War II, and he was he saw the Battle of the Bulge, and he was captured and taken to Dresden. And, of course, his experience as a POW in Dresden became the basis for Slaughterhouse-5. When he came back after the war, he wrote several novels. And the first novels that he wrote are more what one would consider straight science fiction. He wrote Player Piano. He wrote Sirens of Titan,
yeah.
And those are both books that were, they were marketed as straight science fiction, although they, even then, Vonnegut was more interested, I think, in the big ideas of what he was doing and in providing an ironic commentary on the world, and particularly on American attitudes in the post-war era. And Cat's Cradle came along in 63. So it's before Slaughterhouse-5, which most people will consider Vonnegut's masterpiece. And it's certainly the novel that I think more than any other one juggles all those influences of science fiction and sardonic humor and social commentary. Cat's Cradle, in some ways, is a kind of a straight science fiction story.
Last week, as we record this, I went to the World Science Fiction Convention, which was in Spokane, Washington this year. And that's where they give out the Hugo Awards. So, and it is very much a book, science fiction book and writing, short stories and things like that kind of convention. There's, you know, presence of other media types. But unlike something like San Diego Comic-Con, it really is about the writing. The writers are rock stars at that event. And it struck me that there are lots of different kinds of science fiction fandom and science fiction in general. There are lots of different kinds. And when you mention Vonnegut and science fiction, this is what strikes me, is that some science fiction is so concerned with the technical. I guess you'd call it hard science fiction. It's so concerned with what will this technology do in the future to impact our culture. And I love that stuff. But Vonnegut is a very particular kind of science fiction. And I think he is absolutely a science fiction writer or a science fantasy writer, maybe a little more like somebody like Harlan Ellison. He's not concerned with the nuts and bolts. What he's concerned about is having this, these fantastic elements and using them to tell a story that is, yeah, generally remarkably allegorical, and the science fictional elements are there to knock us off our axis and make us look at what he's trying to say in a different way. And I think that's one of my favorite things about science fiction. Growing up on Star Trek, you know, that was at a young age, that was made clear to me that, you know, you can tell a lot of interesting stories just by changing, you know, A to B. And that's what Star Trek did, right? Star Trek was not usually concerned with the nuts and bolts. It was concerned about, we can talk about Vietnam, we can talk about racism by making it be on another planet. And I think Vonnegut absolutely does that. He's literarily acclaimed and all of that, but you know, he knows the science fiction tropes and takes them as far as he needs them to go to serve his purposes, to make jokes and make commentary on society, and that's a different kind of sci-fi than I think a lot of people expect these days, but it's absolutely in the vein of one part of what science fiction was, and you see it from some writers and not so much from others.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me about Vonnegut and his relationship to science fiction, you can sort of see it coming through in Cat's Cradle, but you see it much more in books like Slaughterhouse-Five and Breakfast of Champions, both of which include his alter ego, Kilgore Trout. Which is that he is well aware of the fact that people don't take science fiction seriously, mm-hmm. or they see it as some sort of a debased or rotten form of media. And he's really interested in what constitutes serious discourse. In this book, he does it around religion, and he, in this book, famously creates a religion made up of lies that completely advertise themselves as lies. And he's fascinated with the ways in which authority works with what is considered high art and what is considered low art, and he's constantly poking holes in his own pretension.
Oh yeah, it's you know, science fiction became popular in, you know, essentially it's pulp fiction. It's pulpy stuff. And although there was always, I think, art in it, it originates in a very, it does in a low place. It originates in a low place, and it's low culture. It's for kids, or it's for people who, you know, it's not ever supposed to be highfalutin. And so what you're seeing with Vonnegut is totally aware of that and using it to his advantage, because maybe it throws you off the scent, or maybe as a work of art to take these unlikely things and sort of slap them together. But he's well aware that of science fiction's history, and uses it to his advantage. It's funny that you say, you talk about the religion here, and maybe we can get into this later. Maybe you're planning on doing it, but this book reads like a Marx Brothers movie to me at some points, that you know, all of this is just for him to drop down jokes that are dripping in satire, and the science fictional elements are there, I think, to enable the jokes in some cases, which is fine. Because there are moments where I just think he is just unloading his jokes now. He's just, you know, we can talk about this as literature, but this is a man who has jokes to make at others' expenses.
I will agree that I think that this is very like a Marx Brothers film. I think insofar as the way that the plot works, it works to bring together a bunch of unlikely characters into a small confined space and have them kind of bounce off each other. And that was certainly what all the Marx Brothers films were. Either they would meet in a room on board a steamship, or they would meet inside a high society mansion or whatever.
Right.
It's interesting, though, because like you, although I had read this book several times as a kid, when I reread it now, I was surprised by how much of it I had forgotten. And for me, this book was pretty much all about Ice Nine, which we will talk about, and Bocanonism, which is the religion, which we'll talk about. And all the other characters just kind of flew out of my head, because I think that this is kind of typical of Vonnegut. He's not particularly character-oriented.
No.
He doesn't really care about them.
Well, yeah, and the narrator barely even has a name. But he is... I did start to picture him as Groucho Marx, though, I have to admit, at some point. Because the snappy dialogue, there is just ridiculous snappy dialogue throughout. But you're right, these are not fully fleshed-out characters.
Well, the book starts in a highly self-aware way by having the narrator say, "Call me Jonah," which is, of course, a reference to Call Me Ishmael, which is supposed to be a reference to the kind of a narrator who tells a story but isn't necessarily in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's kind of unfair to Ishmael, actually, as someone who loves Moby Dick, but I did get the reference, and certainly the narrator fades out, or at least he kind of fades into Vonnegut's authorial voice. And that's certainly something that completely took over by the time he wrote Slaughterhouse-Five. It was all Vonnegut telling us exactly how we were supposed to feel about the action of the story. Let's go into the plot here. It starts out, we're introduced to a narrator. He is interested in writing a book, as the book opens, that he calls The End of the World. It was going to be about the development of the atomic bomb, but as he teases, he didn't realize that this was going to become a true work about the end of the world. So we're already telegraphed. And this is the other thing I would say about Vonnegut is I see Douglas Adams all over this.
Oh, God, yes.
There's so much that seems to be, and particularly in the Boconanist sections, it seems to me that kind of voice that Adams must have he must have read this book several times.
It has to be. I mean, it is. I'm sure Douglas Adams had a lot of other influences. Maybe P.G. Wodehouse is in there. I don't know. But it is impossible to read Cat's Cradle, and I would say probably Slaughterhouse-Five and other Vonnegut, and not imagine that this was all absorbed by Douglas Adams. There's no way. I know those Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books backward and forward, and as I was reading Cat's Cradle this time, and it's funny because I read those books about the same time I read the Vonnegut books, and I don't think I made the connection, but it's clear as day to me now that this had to be an influence, a huge influence on Douglas Adams. Had to be.
Right. Okay, so Jonah, or John, as he is, his real name is interested in telling the story of Felix Honecker, who is a Nobel laureate physicist who was, he's made up for the book, by the way, who is responsible for developing the atomic bomb. He was there, I guess, at the Manhattan Project. And so he's trying to find out any stories he can about the day that the bomb went off for the first time. When it was dropped on Hiroshima, and he's calling up this scientist Felix Honecker's kids, or he's writing letters to them. He's able to make a contact with one of the children.
He writes a letter to the fraternity brother, who is what's his name? Newt Honecker, who is a midget. And has famously had an affair with a Russian dancer, but right. And he's been kicked out of the fraternity, I think, in the college. But the letter does go through, and he begins the correspondence with Newt about his father and their family and what happened on the day of the first atom bomb being detonated.
And Newt, we are told, is in fact a midget. I don't want to be non-PC about this.
Is used throughout.
Exactly. And I think this is the traditional sense of a tiny person rather than an actual dwarf. But Newt writes back a letter, as you say. He's being kicked out of his fraternity, and he is happy to talk at some length with Jonah, our narrator.
Keeps his roommate up with the clacking of his typewriter at some point and is told to shut up until morning, and then continues writing the letter the next day. It's a long letter.
Right. So the letter is in many ways a kind of a confessional letter about having had a distant father, an unhappy childhood, and kind of rambling memories of his father on the day that the bomb was dropped. Apparently his father was playing Cat's Cradle, which is where we get the title from. And I always kind of assumed that the idea was that Felix Honecker was so divorced from any sense of responsibility from what he was doing that he was going to engage his time with something so mindless and trivial. But later in the book, Newt talks about how what's horrible about Cat's Cradle is we're taught it as young children, and we're taught to look at the cradle or at the various figures, and there's nothing in there. He sees it as a complete lie.
Yeah, no cat, no cradle. So this is, again, stuff I think I didn't pick up when I read this the first time. So Felix Honecker is really interesting to me. He is obviously Vonnegut's talking about whether this person existed or not. It is this mad scientist, essentially, archetype. It goes back to, you know, like Frankenstein, you see it, obviously, where he is not concerned about the effects of what he does. He's not concerned with the world at all. They want him to work on the bomb, so the government sends some men to their house to take away the stuff that he's interested in. And then he's got nothing else to do, so we might as well work on the bomb again. He is completely disconnected. He's the forgetful genius scientist, doesn't care about how his science is applied. And the Cat's Cradle is part of that too. It's like, this is a man who holds the potential destruction of Earth in his hands. in two ways. And yet on this moment when the atom bomb is detonated over Hiroshima, he is, you know, suddenly pulls out this string and is playing a child's game. It's a fascinating little chunk. And, you know, it's hard not to look at this as being, you know, Vonnegut's screed against science in service, science without morality, I guess, is how I would put it. That even if you are a genius, if you aren't thinking about how your genius can be applied, you still can be morally judged. That they created these horrible things that ultimately destroy the entire world in an alternate way in Cat's Cradle.
I understand that this section was based a bit on something that actually happened in Vonnegut's life, that he was assigned by General Electric to go and interview some of the people who worked on various projects, weapons projects for the government, scientists, and he was shocked when he talked to them about how little they cared about how their findings were used, that they were only interested in pure research. And
right.
There's a lot in this book about when Jonah goes to visit the laboratory where Honecker worked in Ilium, New York. Honecker's former supervisor says, "Oh, you don't understand what pure research is."
Right, right, and that's obviously, yeah. Vonnegut had some history with that, viewing these pure research scientists, and it's interesting because this is kind of the military-industrial complex takedown that he's saying here, which. This is one of his themes. I mean, you see it in Slaughterhouse-Five too. This is a 20th century man through and through, and he's seen the horrors of World War II and is now witnessing the clash of the Cold War with the threat of complete destruction of and pointing to some of that and saying, look, we people are problematic, and you scientists are not taking into account what horrible things we can do with your inventions. And, you know, I think it's interesting. And the idea of being totally disconnected and just sort of not caring as I think in one of my favorite movies, Real Genius, the line is, or is it Max Headroom? Boy, it's Things That I Love. It's like, I just build the bomb, I don't drop it. I think that's Max Headroom. maybe it's both, actually. But it's that idea. It's that this is a trope that has come back again and again, including in some of my favorite things from the 80s. The scientist who doesn't really care if you drop the bomb, because that's not his problem. His problem is just building the bomb, and that's a neat problem to solve. And Honecker is a brutal caricature in that way too. Like he doesn't care about anything in the world. He doesn't care about his kids. He just does not care.
Well, I don't know if we mentioned this before, but Honecker is dead at the beginning of this book, and Jonah is sort of reconstituting his life after the fact. And one of the things he discovers when he goes to Ilium is that Honecker developed a substance called Ice 9, which is, I think, one of the great inventions of this book. In fact, it's probably the thing that will stick with you afterwards. If the concept is that water can be constituted in several different crystalline forms, that regular ice is simply one of those forms, and that there are at least 9 of them. And Ice 9 is one that has a melting point of, 140 degrees?
Yeah, it's a reasonable temperature, but it's above room temperature. So everything, Ice 9 water freezes at room temperature, but if you heat it up to 140 or 150, then it just melts and becomes regular water.
But it also has the property of acting as a seed crystal for the construction of more Ice 9. So if you introduce Ice 9 to anything with moisture, the water will also form into Ice 9, and so instantly things will freeze around it. And he did this, we were told, Honecker did this as a way of addressing the issue of getting military transports through mud and marsh, and thought, oh, here's a way, we'll just make this. And it was kind of an afterthought that it turned out that this could be something that would actually destroy the world.
Yeah, it's I don't know this for sure, but what struck me about this chain reaction thing is that some of the scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project talked about how when they did the first nuclear detonation There was some thought that was not taken too seriously, but they thought there was at least a slight chance that it would kick off, that it would ignite the atmosphere, essentially, and set the entire Earth's atmosphere on fire and kill everybody and destroy the entire world. And they were like, it probably won't happen. Let's go ahead with the test. And that struck me when I was reading this, that's about that same kind of attitude of I guess this could probably kill everybody, but, you know, whatever, we'll try it.
Right. Now, help me out here, because even having just read this book, it makes some plot jumps that I find a little bit hard to understand. He, after the discovery of Ice-9, and after talking to some of the children in Ilium, John finds himself invited. Is it?
Yeah, he's like on an assignment, I think. One of his writing assignments sends him to the Caribbean island of San Lorenzo. I think it's something like that. I think it's coincidental that he ends up, but I'm not sure. It happens very quickly. Then he's like, well, then, and then later I find myself on this airplane going to San Lorenzo. It's a very sudden kind of thing. Or maybe he discovers that the son who was presumed dead, the other Honecker child, is actually this military head in this Caribbean island,
right?
And so for whatever reason, he ends up on a plane headed to San Lorenzo from the United States with a couple of Hoosiers and most of the Honecker, the other two Honecker children are also on that plane.
Also, before he ends up on this plane, he sees a travel brochure, or at least an advertisement,
in
a magazine, to inviting people to come to San Lorenzo. And what he sees is this vision of this beautiful, beautiful woman,
mm-hmm.
that he falls head over heels in love with just on first sight. He doesn't know who she is or what she is, but he knows he has to go find her. And so it becomes very lucky that he's actually invited to San Lorenzo, or assigned to San Lorenzo,
mm.
where he is, as you say, on the flight down to this Caribbean island of San Lorenzo, he runs into a bunch of crazy characters. And
but see, this is one of those Marx Brothers scenes,
right.
that happens here.
Now, the crazy characters include, as you mentioned, a pair of Hoosiers who are kind of parodies of American businessmen, at least a businessman and his wife who want to go to San Lorenzo because they figure it's a great business opportunity, that labor costs will be down there and that the people won't complain when they're set to work. We're also introduced to an elderly couple who are on the diplomatic service and who the gentleman has just been assigned the job of ambassador to San Lorenzo. Again, these are characters that are kind of written as sort of one-joke things, and they don't ever kind of mesh in my head as actual characters, but we do spend a lot of time with them.
Yeah, there's this is where we get introduced to some of the crazy concepts that live in this book. In addition to Ice-9, things that people may remember later are the idea of a caras, which is the a group of people who are linked together, and there's some meaning. They don't all have to be in the same place at the same time, but their lives are linked together in some way that in hindsight you can see that these people mattered. And that the idea of the Grand Falloon, which is a fake caress. It's people who think that they have a connection, but it really doesn't matter. And so when the businessman and his wife talk about their Hoosiers, and look, there's a guy up front who's a Hoosier too, that's an opportunity for the narrator, who at this point hasn't been introduced to Bakuninism, but when he's writing about this period, he is a thorough Bakuninist. Talks about how that's a Grand Falloon. This, and I really liked that this is the, you know, false connection between us. It's like, hey, we're all Americans, or we're all Christians, or whatever. In this case, it's we're all Hoosiers. We have this in common. And his commentary on that is, no, that is a Grand Falloon. It's just a falsehood. It's not. We're not really connected,
right?
Which I think is really interesting, and that the connections are very different. And the siblings, the Honecker siblings, are part of the narrator's Karas. They are connected in a way that he considers important, and the just being from Indiana not important.
Right.
As far as he's concerned.
So we should talk here a little bit about this, because this is the other, I think, great central conceit of the book, is this religion, which we will probably all pronounce six different ways. Bokononism.
Something like that. There's lots of O's. Bokononism, I think, is what I've been saying. Yeah.
It's a religion that was founded by a gentleman on San Lorenzo named Bokonon. And we learn about Bokonon in drips and drabs through the book. There's from about the beginning, there are little hints as to these kinds of concepts from this made-up religion. As you've mentioned, the Karas. We've talked about Foma, which is the Bokonon word for lies, which are not necessarily a bad thing in Bokononism.
Right.
It's just you should be aware that everything you think you know is a lie, and then you should set out to live your life by the lies that make you happy, is
right.
The idea. And this is a religion that is completely made up. It's a highly poetic religion, but also a highly satirical religion. On the one hand, has these concepts like Karas, the idea that you are joined by fate to other people to perform some act on this world that you may not even be aware of. But on the other hand, it seems to posit a sort of meaninglessness or not necessarily nihilism, but the idea that any meaning we give to life has to ultimately come from ourselves.
That's definitely what's going on, you know, is this idea, which I really love. I love this because the beauty of this is it would be very easy for Vonnegut to write this and have it be a scathing indictment of religion, right? It's like, everything in religion is a lie. Believe it if you want, if it makes you feel better, but it's all a lie, and there is no meaning to life, and that's the end, right? And it's not. I mean, what he says here is, yes, we do make our own meaning. Yes, everything in religions are lies, but those can be, you know, the lies can be good and they can be comforting. And if they help you navigate the universe and be better to each other, then maybe they have value. I think I think it's an interesting way for him to approach it outright with Bokononism, which is they admit it. It's like, we admit what no other religion will, which is we do this because it makes you feel better and it's not true, but you could live your life this way and you'd be better off.
Let's take a moment here to listen to the reading from the book, which is not necessarily from this section of the book, but that's okay because the Bokononist segments kind of fade in and out and are scattered throughout the book. This is to give a little flavor of the religion. This is the Bokononist creation story.
In the beginning, God created the earth, and he looked upon it in his cosmic loneliness. And God said, "Let us make living creatures out of mud, so the mud can see what we have done." And God created every living creature that now moveth, and one was man. Mud as man alone could speak. God leaned close as mud as man sat up, looked around and spoke. Man blinked. "What is the purpose of all this?" he asked politely.
"Everything must have a purpose,"
asked God. "Oh, certainly," said man.
"Then I leave it to you to think of one for all this," said God, and he went away.
I really love this. I think the creation, this creation part that we just heard, and the and the last rites, which is related to it, they're connected, are beautiful, I think. I was actually moved, the point at which I was moved almost to tears, maybe to tears, in the whole book is when they give the last rites. Because, you know, they're not wrong. This is the beautiful thing of, like, you know, there's the universe and these, you know, the people, the mud people come out of the mud. We're all made of just the atoms of the universe. We're made from star stuff, as Carl Sagan taught us. And then we go back to it, and that's life. That's how it is. And so, you know, I find beauty in this, that, you know, God is present in this and basically says, good luck. and then he takes off. But it's really touching when they read the last rites and it says, you know, hey, I was mud. And then I got to walk around on the, and see the universe for a while. So I've got nothing to complain about. And now I'll go back to being mud. It's like I said, I really like this. I'm not sure I'm ready to sign up to be a Bakoninist yet, but I like how it's beautiful while also being absurd.
As they approach the island, our narrator is filled in a little bit about this religion, and he's told that Bokanon is this notorious criminal.
Illegal religion, and he's an outlaw.
Right, and when they land, there are posters up showing him saying, have you seen this man? He's supposed to be captured, and if he's ever captured, he's going to be put on the hook, which is the way that all enemies of the state are dealt with in San Lorenzo, which is basically an enormous hook that you're impaled on.
Yeah.
So,
again, we admit it. This is what we do.
Right.
I love it.
So they come to San Lorenzo, and San Lorenzo is in some ways a parody of Cuba, I would guess, at this time, because the Cuban Revolution had just taken place very shortly before this novel was written, and it is in some ways that kind of tin pot dictator, you know, the little banana republic run by a crazy military guy. But we learn over time that it actually has a kind of a fascinating little history, that this this island was visited by Bokanon, who was not Bokanon when he visited it. He was just a guy from Philadelphia whose name was Johnson, I think.
And, yeah, Lionel Boyd Johnson.
And he came there with his friend. What was his friend's
name? Earl McCabe.
Earl McCabe. And they decided...
The sergeant.
They were both people who had seen a lot of the world and seen a lot of the sadness of the world. And when they came to San Lorenzo, they decided they were going to set up Bokanonism as a way of making people's lives happier and more beautiful. And built into that plan was the idea that Bokanon himself had to be made an outlaw, because it had to be attractive to people to engage in this illicit practice. And McCabe was complicitous in this. He took on the role of being the island's dictator, but eventually that role took him over and he actually did become a dictator.
There is so much here, and also things that I would never have known when I was 14 or 15. But, like, first off, there's the whole, you know, you need a god and you need a devil kind of aspect to this, which is which they decide we're going to create this polarized society. And then this has got to be a commentary on the... or at least be informed by communist countries outlawing religion and being officially atheist, and that creating this undercurrent of unofficial religions that are still practiced, like Cuba, right? Cuba, a very Catholic country, and yet communism really tried to suppress all religion because it was supposed to be about the state. And likewise, Russian Orthodox churches were really suppressed in the Soviet Union. So that's going on here too. There's just, you know, Vonnegut is just mining so much from this period, especially. These are such 20th century kind of ideas that you're seeing him remix with the story of San Lorenzo.
Right. When he comes to the island, John, our narrator, looks around, is introduced to the current dictator of the island, Papa Manzano, and he has adopted the woman John fell in love with.
The most beautiful woman.
Right.
Yes.
The most beautiful woman on the island, named Mona, as his stepdaughter. and they're about to engage in a passage of power from Papa Manzano to the son, the missing Honecker son, who is shown up on the island, and who there's going to be a state wedding, and the younger Honecker is going to take over as ruler of San Lorenzo. And we're told that the narrator can't stand this because he's obsessed with Mona.
Yeah, well, he loves her from seeing her. It's a fascinating scene where we where the narrator notices that she's taken off her shoes and is rubbing her foot against the one of the pilots who's going to be in the air show the next day. And I think the narrator is noting there that, you know, what's the story here? Is she not committed to this guy? And what we find out is that Felix Honecker's son Frank takes after his father. Essentially, that he's not even focused on people. He's not interested. He just wants to do technical things, and so he's not really interested in her. He's not interested in being the president. You know, none of that. He just wants to play with his toys. Essentially, he's very, very much like his father. This is also, by the way, where we learn, and this is another great little Vonnegut commentary in this case about the pointlessness of war, that they're going, the U.S. ambassador is there for this this Memorial Day for the 100 martyrs to democracy of San Lorenzo. And it turns out when they, and you can sign, as an adult, you can see it coming. It turns out, how did they die? Is they put them on a boat and they were going to send them off to World War II, and they left the harbor and a U-boat sunk the boat. And that was it. And they all died, and that was the end. And that was their contribution to World War II. And that's a, you know, that's a, I guess since this came before Slaughterhouse-Five, I would say that is an indicator of where he was going with Slaughterhouse-Five, because that was a little moment where he's just saying, see, these are our war heroes. And in fact, later, the American ambassador throws away his nice script and says, you threw away their lives, and this is the shame of war. And that's a moment where he kind of, I feel like maybe Vonnegut sort of steps outside the book for a minute and gives us a little bit of a speech. But I liked that they have this whole thing about the martyrs for democracy, the honored dead. And it turns out they died in the most pointless fashion, just like on their way to go to war.
One thing that we have been told, it hasn't actually entered into the plot line so much, but we have been told by the narrator that was that after Felix Honecker's death, the children, the three Honecker children, had taken the Ice Nine that was left over and split it up amongst them. And it is one of the reasons that Frank is there, is that San Lorenzo is interested in getting their hands on Ice Nine.
Yeah, well, I feel like it turns out that everything that's happening is about Ice Nine. I mean, I think we learn as we go along that the one son's girlfriend, the Russian acrobat or dancer or whatever she was, she's a Soviet spy who's getting Ice Nine, and I think the husband of the daughter who has this unhappy marriage, that he's actually in the U.S. military and has taken possession of Ice Nine, that there is a Cold War game being played all around them while this goes on this ridiculous island, which, I mean, to your point, that's, you know, that's a Cuban Missile Crisis kind of waiting to happen, if there ever was one.
And I think it's very pointedly showing that once the cat is out of the bag, there's no containing this. It's sort of like, yeah, there was possibly a chance that if Felix Honecker had just melted the Ice Nine when he had it, it would be gone.
Yeah.
But once, I think the object lesson here is nobody can control what happens to the weapons once they're in the world.
Right.
And that's, I think, you know, a lesson that Vonnegut very much wants us to take and apply more generally from this book. In any case, Papa Manzano wants to pass off the leadership of the island. Frank does not want to accept the leadership of the island, and he suggests our narrator.
Yeah, this is another Groucho Marx kind of moment. Sure, we'll put this guy in charge. Papa is dying, and
he has cancer.
And Frank does not want the job. So he says, hey, I got a plan. Well, it's more absurd than that, right? He says, I'm going to send you to, he has a weird encounter at a hotel. We didn't even talk about that. The empty hotel with the artist who's painting the mural, who is actually the guy who wrote the book. That's the one history of San Lorenzo that the narrator read on the plane ride down with the questionable index in the back, where one of the wife of the diplomat on the plane can tell you all about his personality by reading his index, because authors should never be self-indexers, because they give everything away and they do a bad job. Just complete throwaway, ridiculous, funny stuff. And he's taken from the hotel with the one guest in it, which is him, and taken to the palace, which is this like James Bond villain-esque redoubt with a waterfall and a secret bunker and all of this stuff, and is told to wait there, and that Frank will come at some point and tell him something really important. And so you get another stretch of time where there's this absurd waiting that he has to do, because he's necessary for something but has no idea what. And ultimately Frank comes and says, look, Papa's gonna die. I don't like people, and I'm not good with people, and I'm not interested in being president, and you're a writer and seem good with people, so why don't you be president?
Right.
And if you say yes, then you can marry Mona, the most beautiful woman in the world, instead of me, and get me out of that, too. To which I think the narrator basically says, okay.
Sure.
I'll do it.
Our narrator surrenders to his fate, and Papa Manzano is being attended to by a former SS officer. Again, this is another thing I think that was on everyone's mind at this time, because there were stories all through the 60s and 70s of former Nazis surfacing in Cuba and in Argentina.
And again, yeah. I like the nuanced take Vonnegut has, which is, I see what he's doing. He's trying to pay off the debt of the terrible thing he did by working in hospitals. So it's like, I see that. But, and they say, we estimate that at the rate of patients that he cares for here in this hospital, he will have paid off the debt of all the people who died in the camps by the year 2300.
Right.
Which is just, it's a beautiful, poisonous little part that I thought was really great.
Sure. And Papa decides he does not want to linger.
Right.
And he gets his hand on Frank's sample of Ice-9 and ingests it, and immediately turns into a statue. And when our narrator sees this, he gets everyone to agree they've got to take the body. They've got to make sure that this body gets incinerated, because it's just a miracle that it hasn't already infected everyone around it. And he's fully aware of the dangers that this corpse presents.
Hmm.
But nonetheless, the body is stuffed into a closet until such time as it can be dealt with. And that is after the state ceremony that will instill him as the leader of San Lorenzo, which includes, as you mentioned before, an air show.
Gotta have an air show.
And one of the pilots, perhaps the one that performed Bokumaru, which is the rubbing of feet together with Mona, crashes his plane into the side of this big palatial estate, causing a huge crack to go through the entire building until it reaches the closet where Papa Manzano is waiting. His body topples out of the palace and into the water, and instantly all of the water encircling San Lorenzo is turned to Ice-9, and by implication, within a few hours, all the water that is connected to that to the Caribbean will also have turned to ice nine. So this is the end of the world.
Yeah. Oops.
Oops.
I mean, it's just I love the absurdity of it, and this is again one of those things that's really nice about this is a, you know, almost Dr. Strangelove kind of satire of, you know, even when you think you've got it under control, you don't have it under control, and that's what he's saying. And you mentioned it before. It's like even when you think you can clamp down on it, it's out in the world, and something bad's going to happen, and all it takes is a little mistake. So they make, you know, he kills himself, and they try to clean it up, and they do a good job. They boil the water or melt the water, and then it's melt the ice nine into regular water. Then it's not a problem anymore. But they've got the body, and they're going to burn the bodies, but they don't burn them fast enough. And, you know, and the German doctor freezes, and it's like they're so close, but then there's one person makes a mistake. And the world ends. Like at some point, it doesn't really matter that you're trying not to use it. So, inevitably, it will happen, and so that's what happens. And it's a crazy moment. This is the moment that I remember all these years later, before I reread the book, was the freezing of the ocean. It's like, how could you not? The end of the world happens in an instant, and everything turns white, you know, as far as out as you can see on the sea. And it, you know, that's it. All because the one plane crashed because it had a problem with its engine or something.
Right. Now, John has managed to not touch any of the Ice Nine. Mm-hmm. And Mona as well. They wander out into the world where there are basically people frozen hither and yon. As they some people have escaped, but very few. And they find a large pile of corpses, and they learn from one of the survivors that Bocanon himself had suggested that the remaining San Lorenzians taste the Ice Nine and kill themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mona, on hearing this, decides that it's a kind of a lovely scene. She picks up a chip of Ice Nine and touches it to her lips. And it happens in a flash, and it's not played at all for laughs or anything. It's
no.
This is
it's an echo of the previous scene. So when they're in the bunker, they spend a few weeks in this bunker that is in the redoubt of by the waterfall. And it's got two beds, and he's very excited because basically he's the last man on Earth, and the last woman on Earth is the woman he loves, who's the most beautiful woman ever. And it's a funny moment, I think, a sad, darkly funny moment where he says, well, we can have sex now. And she's like, well, yeah, but, you know, would you want to bring a baby into this world? And that's one of the consequences. And you get the sense that she's... You know, her philosophy as a Bocanonist is at odds with his, and there's a lot there, but it's kind of funny in that sense that, you know, okay, finally I've got this moment with this beautiful woman, and she's like, yeah, but it's the end of the world, right? It's like, it's over. And that's echoed when she kills herself, that she asked him a question, and she's basically asking him again, is there anything to live for? And she asks him, and he thinks about it, and she says, too late. You know, like, if you have to think about it that long, then that's the answer. And then she kills herself. So it kind of puts it on him a little bit. Like, he didn't respond in time, but it also is like, she's proving her point that, you know, there's nothing to live for. So I'm going to go with the rest of the people of my island.
John survives, and is able to meet up with, the two surviving Hanukkah-sans and
the Hoosiers.
The Hoosiers are all, camped out in a safe spot that is separate from the water sources. I don't know exactly how they're getting any new water into this place, but I'm not going to worry too much about that.
I figure there's real water, moisture. Water is safe, so water, moisture in the atmosphere, and it's a tropical island, so it might even rain on them, or there's a stream or something that for whatever reason is not connected.
Yeah, they might have a reservoir or something, but they're living in relative comfort, basically by themselves in this kind of safe house, and it's here that we learn that John reads the books of Bocanon and becomes a Bocanonist. So one of the things that's funny about this book is we've been teased throughout the book that our narrator will eventually adopt this religion that he's talking about, and you keep expecting there to be this moment of conversion, and it comes after the end of the world.
Yeah. It's the ultimate deathbed conversion. It's like, yeah, I guess so. I guess this is this absurd. So he becomes a Bokanonist. He reads these books and all of that. And then they're like driving down a road in the one taxi on the island, which they have access to, which has remained. And that's a really funny moment, too, where they're like, hey, I think we just drove past Bokanon back there. And they back up. I can envision that scene in my mind. It's like they come back to Bokanon, who's sitting by the side of the road trying to write the last line of the books of Bokanon.
And it ends on the last line where he says that that if he were a younger man and had his strength, he would climb to the top of Mount McCabe, which is the highest mountain on the island, and make a statue of himself thumbing his nose at God.
Yeah.
And we run out on that.
That's it. That's it. And he's asking, funny thing is, he's asking the narrator basically, what do you think? This is how I'm thinking of ending my book here at the end of the world. What do you think? The end. It's amazing.
Right. Now, I kind of love the endings of this book because sometimes you get to this point at the end of a book where an author doesn't quite know what to do, and it ends with a lot of sort of epilogues tagged on.
Right.
And this... I don't know that any of this stuff was thematically necessary, but they're just beautiful little crazy little endings. And Vonnegut is confounding our need for closure in a way. You know, we would either expect that there would be some definite salvation of the human race or some definite moment where our heroes died. But no, we don't get either of those things.
Yeah, I mean, you do get the sense that this is the end and they're just running out the clock now. Although it is this is a pretty bad apocalypse as apocalypses go, but it's not like there isn't a solution in the sense that once the water is liquid again, all you need is some heat. You can melt it and it's drinkable and it freezes back into normal ice at that point. So, you know, there might be ways to survive. But again, it's sort of not the point, especially there in the Caribbean. So it's going to be very difficult for them to get anywhere. And I don't know, could you ice skate back to Florida or something? I don't know. But in the end, yeah, it's a story about the end of the world and about a human caused end of the world. And you got to meet Bokanon. I feel like that's the real reason why the story ends when it does. And I suppose he could have structured it where they meet Bokanon earlier, but it does seem sort of fitting that you meet the prophet at the very end of the world, which is also the end of the book. And so it is kind of funny that we have this moment where the narrator's in the cave with Mona, and then they go walk around, and then he's in the lair with Mona, and then he's in the cave with the Hoosiers and the Sons. And, you know, and then they're just like tooling around the island in a taxi when they run into Bokanon. It's kind of funny in how casual it is. Like, the world has ended. They're still alive. What do you do then? And then they finally we get to meet Bokanon, who's thinking about how to finally thumb his nose at God before the world ends.
Now, back when I did the reading for Fahrenheit 451, I made a comparison between Vonnegut and Bradbury that my host didn't really, I think, pick up on. And I'm going to try again here to make my case because why not? The thing I wanted to say is both Bradbury and Vonnegut, to me, strike me as coming from that school of, you talked about it earlier, of sort of 50s, 60s science fiction that was not particularly interested in science in any way, but more interested in these kinds of big allegorical ideas. And in Bradbury's case, I think he was more self-consciously poetic. I think in Vonnegut's case, he was more self-consciously humorous. And I think that Bradbury has always struck me as a science fiction writer who's been tapping on the other side of the literary establishment, trying to get some recognition, and whatever recognition he has is basically Fahrenheit 451. That's the one book that people will kind of grudgingly say, well, sure, he can be taught in schools for that book. But Vonnegut is kind of a critical darling. There's a lot of reasons, I think, for this. I do think that Vonnegut is the stronger writer. And I think that the other thing is that Bradbury, to me, strikes me as really trying a little too hard. He's a little too concerned that you get the fact that he's writing about very important issues. And Vonnegut, ironically, by making light of these things, makes them much more frightening and much more, I think, powerful.
Yeah, I would say also, I feel like I love Vonnegut's writing style, but I think Vonnegut doesn't care about being beautiful. And I think Bradbury kind of cared about being beautiful. I think he wanted to write really beautiful prose. And, you know, maybe it's unfair for me to say that, but I mean, that is just sort of the feeling. And he did write beautiful prose. But I think in the end, I like Vonnegut's writing better because it feels completely it's almost like it's hard to see him working at it. It seems almost effortless to me in some ways. Like, he doesn't care. He just does it, and it's there, and it's so good. But I don't know. It's hard for me to say. They're very different writers in a lot of ways. But I see your point that they both are from this school of thought of that, and there are a lot of writers like that up to the present day who they love the genre tropes. But the point is not to imagine how technology influences our culture, and their point is not how, you know, to imagine what future cultures will be like when technological advancements happen. Their point is more to take these fantastical forms, fantastical things that happen, and use them to tell kind of interesting stories that aren't about the things. Like, this is not about Ice Nine. He tosses off how Ice Nine works in a couple of paragraphs. And, you know, it's not about that. It's just, suffice it to say, there's a thing that could destroy the world if it's deployed. And that's all that matters. And you know, that I like that. Like, Bradbury in Fahrenheit 451, right? I mean, it is, you know, he's telling a story about totalitarianism. And you know, it's like, or 1984, honestly, with Orwell. The details of how it works aren't important. And I think some science fiction readers really like books that are about the details. And I think a lot of people who aren't science fiction readers think that that's what science fiction is. And it's not. And I think that's maybe why some of these authors have respectability the nuts and bolts science fiction writers maybe have less of.
The other thing I would say about Bradbury and Vonnegut is they both were Midwesterners from the boonies, and they both were trying to make it big as writers. And what I see in Bradbury, certainly in Fahrenheit 451, is this desire to kind of play at the game of high art. He has characters who are constantly quoting classical sources. And you see in Vonnegut a guy who wears his common man origins openly and without shame. This is who I am. I'm a guy from Indiana. Take me or leave me. And that's what I find fascinating about looking at the two of them together. But I do want to now talk about this whole issue of science fiction versus literary fiction, because you did bring up the names that I would bring up. People like certainly Orwell, you know, along with 1984, I'd throw in a novel like Brave New World, or even a novel like Frankenstein. These are novels that today I don't think most people even think of as science fiction, because they think of them as sort of works of world literature. And I'm curious as to why some books get pushed over and what happens when they get pushed over, why people refuse to acknowledge these things as works of science fiction.
I don't know. That's a good question, and we could make a list of things. You could make a list of things that are science fiction that should be considered literature and not have people in English classes roll their eyes at them. And likewise, you could probably find things that are science fiction and don't want to admit it, and that people don't, or that people in science fiction don't want to embrace them. I don't know. I mean, there are always people who want to set up these barriers, and I find it kind of fascinating. I mean, like, Michael Chabon is one of my favorite writers, and he has written so many novels that are of a genre, and he gets away with it because he, you know, won a lot of awards and is respectable-like. But even the Cavalier in Clay is just drenched in comic book lore and other, and there's like golem stuff in there. And I mean, it is about magic and fantasy. And then he wrote the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which is an alternate history. And he wrote Summerland, which is a fantasy that has fairies that play baseball. And yet he is a literary author. So it's okay. It's safe. I don't know. It's a strange one. Also, sometimes, you know what? Sometimes it's the publishers that are afraid to get a book that they think can have broad appeal. They're afraid to have it be pigeonholed to science fiction or fantasy. So they will often release it, you know, and say, put this in the fiction. On the spine of the book, it'll say, you know, fiction or novel and not science fiction or fantasy, because they're afraid it'll get put in a section where a lot of, at least in the days when people bought books at bookstores, where people wouldn't look. People wouldn't go in there because I'm not a science fiction reader. My mom was like that. My mom introduced me to science fiction, but she's not a science fiction reader. And so I would find books. I'd say, yeah, I think you might like this, even though it's got a science fictional aspect to it. So I think labels are funny. And it's funny that we even talk about this when the highest grossing movies of all time are almost entirely science fiction fantasy movies. But when it comes to books, people are like, no, no, no. Even now, whatever it is, 90 years after the first sort of pulp science fiction started to appear on the scene, 80 years, whatever, there's still that from some people who are like, no, 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 I'm not going to read that stuff. So I don't know. It's funny to see it in, like I mentioned, Stranger in a Strange Land being assigned in an English class. And I read Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin for an English class. And it was great. And absolutely one of the best things that I read in that class. And I'm sure that some people were like, really? This is set on an alien planet with three gendered aliens? Really? It's like, yes, really. But I don't know. I mean, labels. People love them.
There are accepted novels in the literary canon, like Don DeLillo's White Noise or David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, that have strong science fiction elements to them. But I don't think any of the reviewers of the New York Review of Books would consider those things as science fiction.
I appreciate being on. I appreciate reading this book. We talked a lot about other books that we could have read that would have been very much more like torture. And instead, Vonnegut, such a good writer, doesn't feel dated, honestly. I mean, the subject matter is a little bit dated, and yet the prose is I love his prose style. I love his sense of humor. I think this would have made a great Marx Brothers movie. Somebody's got a time machine. I think you could work with, you know, pick up Kurt Vonnegut on the way, head back to the height of the Marx Brothers and do something there, because the dialogue is hilarious, the scenes are absurd, and yet it manages to say some meaningful things about life as well as about kind of the absurdity of our modern day and modern technology. And this is a book that I didn't like. This was the one I didn't like, because I loved Slaughterhouse-Five so much. And reading it now, I thought it was fantastic. It makes me want to go back and read all Vonnegut again, because he is so good. And this book is short. It is fast read. It is incredibly funny. So, you know, what's not to like? This is the kind of book that if you're in your sophomore lit class, you feel lucky to have been assigned it, because they could have chosen things that were much more painful than this. And this was a delight, and more of a delight to read it as an adult when I got a whole lot more of the absurdity of it than I did, I think, when I was 15.
I'd like to thank my co-host, Jason Snell. You can find him on the web at theincomparable.com, relay.fm, and sixcolors.com. I'd also like to thank Phil Gonzalez for his reading from the Books of Bokanon. Listen to his podcast, Deep in Bear Country, at bernsteinbearcast.wordpress.com. If you'd like to join in the discussion about Sophomore Lit, please visit us on our Facebook page, or you can write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Cat's Cradle is copyright 1963 Kurt Vonnegut. I'm still figuring out what we'll read for next time, so keep reviewing your notes. Remember, everything will be on the final.